you were telling us about how you got into cardiology.
So shortly, I was associated with Dr. Bird, the teaching of cardiology to the third and fourth year students, very actively so, because I didn't have much else to do. Those were the days when you got out and practiced some medicine. You didn't have the experience that the youngsters have today.
Did you teach cardiology right out of medical school without having specialized in cardiology?
I'm coming to that. Yes, I helped Dr. Hurd the first year, a year and a half, in his classroom work. And I had lots of time because my practice would not consume more than about 2 hours a day. I could easily take care of it in 2 hours a day. So I spent most of my time at the hospital, which was a Lutheran hospital run by Lutheran sisters.
At the Pasadena.
And they were very nice to me. They gave me all sorts of opportunities. As I say, luck has so much to do with one's development. Then Sir Thomas Lewis, who was a pioneer in the development of the electrocardiography, which is a method of studying and diagnosing disease at heart, was visiting Pittsburgh, giving the Mellon Lecture, which is an annual lecture at the medical school, or it was, financed by the Mellons. And Dr. Hurd knew him and invited me for lunch with Sir Thomas Lewis. I remember we went to the Pittsburgh Golf Club. And during that lunch, Hurd asked Dr. Lewis if he would like to have me come and serve a fellowship with him. Those were the days where residencies were unknown. And I grabbed the opportunity. I still don't know where I got the money for it, but I quit practice and went to London. I was in the University College Hospital with Sir Thomas. And I always talk about this because the very luxurious and expensive surroundings that research people have access to today were just not known. Here was Dr. Lewis, who did this magnificent work known all over the world, in getting electrocardiography on its feet. And he had two small rooms in the basement of the University College Hospital where he had the animals and the cardiograph machine and his books and his literature and everything else. And he did. So it's not always necessary to have luxurious surroundings and expensive equipment to be able to do decent work. At any rate,
I was going to say, how long was the fellowship?
For a year. And then I came back to Pittsburgh and became very active in the teaching of cardiology. We had a heart station at St. Francis Hospital, and I helped in the heart station there. And Dr. Hurd was a curious person. I have a picture of him right there someplace. He gave me an appreciation. That's right. He hated Negroes, he hated Jews, he's very bigoted, but very cultured. Knew music, knew literature, he lived on Ellsboro Avenue. And it was very difficult with all the memories that I had of the past to work with him, but it did offer me he hated Catholics too. He was a typical WASP. His brother, as a matter of fact, was a senior member of the firm of Reed Smith Shaw, and he passed away just recently. Very fine gentleman. So I worked with Dr. Hurd, had lots of time, for some 15 years in the medical school. Clinic, teaching, undergraduate teaching. And Dr. Arthur Coker, whose picture you see there, visited Pittsburgh to conduct a seminar. And immunology was in its infancy. Very little was really known about it. And Dr. Haythorne, who was then chairman of the Department of Pathology, chaired the seminar, and I was there, and I was fascinated by this man, by how he talked and what he knew. And I said something to Dr. Haythorne about it, and I said, well, why don't you go to New York and spend some time with him? Coker was then professor of immunology at Cornell. He was president of a very distinguished organization, the Association of American Immunologists, of which I happen to be a member now. And also editor of Journal of Immunology, which is quite the journal. So I spent about 4 or 5 months with Dr. Polka, and when I came back, I was so fascinated by immunology that I decided that that would be my avocation. I continued to teach in cardiology, and around that time I was chief of medicine at the Montefiore and chief of cardiology at the Montefiore, and had charge of the heart station at the Montefiore. So I had a dual appointment, the medical school and the Montefiore, and this was before the Montefiore was in any way connected with the school, and Dr. Hurd gave me the sophomores to teach at the Montefiore physical diagnosis.
Did you have a private practice during these years?
Well, during these years, of course, I left the Hill and came down the May Building, and I helped Dr. E.R. Gardner, who was on the staff of the Passavant, in return for what I did for him, he let me have a small room with a desk and the use of his secretary and to see my own patients. I didn't have too many. So little by little, immunology started pushing cardiology out of the picture against my will. And I finally gave up cardiology at the Montefiore and at the school and developed an outpatient clinic at the school and an outpatient clinic at the Montefiore in clinical immunology and allergy. And that was quite a professionally traumatic experience because I didn't want to leave cardiology. But I just couldn't do both and do it well, or do it reasonably well. So that's the story, and since then I became quite active in the field. I think ours in Pittsburgh was the second approved residency in clinical immunology. We had it first at the Montefiore, and then we transferred to the school and the Veterans Hospital. And I became quite active in national organizations dealing with the subject.
Is Montefiore then the first hospital in the city to have this kind of service?
Yes. The university was the second.
Both due to you?
Yes. I had lots of time, so it was a lot of fun to do both. And then when the age of statutory senility comes on, and I was retired from active at the Montefiore and at the school, the school was very nice about it and still is. Gave me an appointment as director of clinical immunology at the Veterans Hospital, where I still continue to have this fellowship that I've been training. Oh, it's been in existence now for some 26 years, and that plaque that you see there has the names of all the residents that we have trained here at the Montefiore and the school. Some of them are in South America. They're scattered all over the country, some 60 now that have graduated. These boys take a year of internship, 2 years of internal medicine, and 2 years with me, and we still have the active training now.
Where is it?
At the Veterans Hospital and the school. Fall Clinic and the Veterans Hospital. And my position at the Veterans Hospital is not only in caring for patients, outpatients and inpatients at the local station, but we have a central laboratory, which is quite an extensive operation at the Aspinwall Veterans Hospital, which prepares, standardizes and supplies the materials that are used all over the entire country by all the veterans' hospitals and outpatient departments for the diagnosis and treatment of allergic patients.
Tell me a little more about the course that you were responsible for starting.
Oh, well, as I said before, the school was very nice, even though I gave up my activities with undergraduate teaching. I continued with the postgraduate teaching, and we have been all for the past 35 years having a course under the auspices of the Montefiore Hospital, of the school. At first, the joint sponsorship of the Montefiore and the school, long before the Montefiore was part of the school or the health center. And then, under the joint sponsorship of the school and the Veterans Administration. And we hold it every year. This year, well, once before, we held a course about 15 years ago in Atlantic City with the joint sponsorship of the American College of Physicians, which is a well-known society of internal medicine. And this year, for the first time, we're holding it in Palm Beach. And the school thought it might be nice to hold it someplace away from Pittsburgh and see what the response would be. We've been getting a registration of 250 to 300 physicians from all over the country.
How long is the course?
For 5 days. We have now, so far, about 260 registrants. Turn the tape off.
Tell me about the fellowship.
Well, for a physician to qualify to take examinations for board certification, which assures the public and others that the man has had proper training.
Certification in?
In whatever specialty he wants to follow, whether it's cardiology or gastroenterology or clinical immunology and allergy. Now, what he has to do is to take 1 year of internship. And now the thing has changed. And 1 year of residency in internal medicine. And then 2 years of a fellowship in the specialty that he intends to qualify for, cardiology, immunology, and so on. So the fellowship that we are conducting is a 2-year fellowship in clinical immunology and allergy, which qualifies the physician at the end of that to take an examination. And upon passing that exam, he gets a certificate which certifies that he's board certified.
And that fellowship is?
2 years at the Veterans Hospital and the school.
In other words, the fellowship, in addition to the year of residency and the year of internship, makes the person board eligible.
Right. Then he takes his examination. And if he passes that examination, he gets a certificate. Now, that certificate entitles him, in many instances, outstanding hospitals like the Montefiore or the Presbyterian and so on, will not put a man on the staff unless he's board certified. It also gives the public, although many don't know, some reasonable assurance that the man who's taking care of them has at least had proper training. That doesn't mean that it always holds good, but it's some reasonable assurance that he's had proper training.
Besides teaching, as you do, is there anything else that you do in the field of medicine?
Well, at the present time, part of the teaching and part of one's professional progress involves participating and contributing something to the knowledge of medicine. And you do that by relating in print your professional experiences, writing papers, and in my case, I've enjoyed writing some books. And what you see here are the books that I have written. Now, this has been a lot of fun. It has, to some extent, interfered with our social activities and with other things, but Marla's been very tolerant, and it has been very helpful. Now, one of these books has been translated in Spanish, one has been translated in Italian, and not so long ago, I received this book. And in going over it, it was in Russian. Of course, I didn't know what it was all about until I saw some pictures. And I realized that it were pictures from one of my books. And shortly afterwards, I received a letter from a man who is chairman of the committee on research or something in the Moscow, the State Control Institute for Medical and Biological Preparations in Moscow, telling me that, thanking me for the opportunity of translating my book. See, they don't follow copyright laws at all, and inviting me and Merla to come to visit with him. I've been very anxious to go to Russia, but I can't, after Merla found out what your experience was, And somebody else's experience, she just simply wouldn't budge, and I wouldn't go anywhere without her.
Will you tell me the names of the books that you have written?
Well, the first book was a small book called Essentials of Allergy. A friend of mine was very nice to get the book and bind it. Dr. Shapiro, Bill Shapiro, who I never forget, bind it in leather. Then they're on the subject of clinical immunology and allergy.
You'll give us a list of the books.
Well, published. The kids were very nice. On my 70th birthday, they surprised me and collected all the papers that I published and had them bound in those three volumes that you see there. About 150 papers.
What percentage of your time was spent teaching and writing? What percentage?
50%.
50%.
50% of your time was spent teaching.
Still is.
And 50% of your time was spent in private practice.
Now tell me something
about... Well, part of this time was involved in... most of our fun after marriage was involved in traveling. People didn't know any better would invite me to come and give a talk, and all of what you see there, honorary memberships in various South American societies where I've been invited to give a talk, and they didn't give me some kind of a diploma or some kind of honorary membership certificate. It was a lot of fun.
Were you able to take your family with you on some of these trips?
I never went any place without Myrna.
What about the children?
Yes. When I was invited to Argentina and Brazil, Marla was scared of flying, and I didn't want to go alone. So I said to Marla that when Susie comes home, you know, every once in a while we'd have a session, which involved something about curfew and things of that sort. And I no sooner would start on what I was going to preach, but what Susie would say, "Oh, Daddy," and she'd walk away. And I said to Marla one day, as I was sitting on the porch, "Now, when Susie comes home, I'm going to talk to her, whatever the problem was. And if she is attentive and listens, I'm taking her to South America with me." And sure enough, she comes in. I know Marla didn't tell her about it. And I start telling her whatever the problem was. And then I said, "How would you like to come to South America?" And with that, she let out the scream that you could hear clear down to Forbes Street. And we had quite the trip, because the then president of Brazil was a physician. And he funded a postgraduate course in various branches of medicine and surgery in Rio at the state hospital, and at the state university and hospital. And one of my residents was then professor of medicine at this hospital, and he invited me. And there were people from Europe, there were people from various places. As a matter of fact, a neurosurgeon, a young man from Harvard, was Susie's companion during that trip. She had herself a ball.
Would you say that most of your did you have family vacations other than the vacations with your wife when you went?
Well, of course, when the kids, you know, I didn't mention when you asked me about hobbies that for 25 years after marriage I had a boat on the rivers here, and the boat was my outlet because I loved it, and I still wish I were on the river instead of at the country club.
That is right here in Pittsburgh.
Right here in Pittsburgh, that's right, on the rivers. And Marla got tired of being a hostess on the boat, and most of her friends belonged to the club, and some of my then patients, the Lehmans, felt it would promote my professional career if I joined the country club.
What country club did you belong to?
The Westmoreland.
Did you belong to any other clubs?
Concordia. So when the kids were young, they would naturally, we would all go out on the boat together. Well, there came a time when, of course, they no longer were interested in going boating with the family. But up until they grew up, we naturally were on the boat together, and we took trips together. We went to Bemis Point, for example, I remember, and to this place in West Virginia, Deer Creek, Deer Lake, or something like that. So we did, but as the kids grew up, they wanted to get to live their own social life, and that was it.
Would you like to talk about your social life? Something.
Well, it really has not been. We have a rather limited number of acquaintances and friends that we get together. I'm not a card player. I wish I were, because as you get older, this is a very fine social outlet. But I don't have the ability. I'm not oriented in card playing. So we go out for dinner, and we go out to the club, and we play golf. My golf leaves much to be desired, but I quit counting scores, and I use it for what joy I can get out of it in the way of exercise and fun, and it satisfies me.
You live mostly on Melbourne Street.
Yes, after marriage we moved into our house, and we've been living there since then.
Is there much change in that neighborhood since you've lived there?
I would say yes, there is some change on the lower part of Malvern Street, but it's very interesting. A great many younger people, and many of them who are on the faculty of the School of Medicine, live there now. That's about all the changes that have occurred.
Do you know of much change in the neighborhood from when, before you were married, when you were a child?
Well,
what
really
happened that neighborhood?
Well, I think it was perhaps a little more affluent neighborhood before we moved in. When we built our house, the street was still occupied by more affluent people than those that live there now. Although I think that those who live there now, those that I know, are more intellectually oriented and younger.
Is there any community involvement other than medical, the medicine that you are active in?
No, not that I'm active in. I am a member, of course, of a temple. But that is more of a formal membership. I really, as I said before, I'm not, this is not an excuse but justification. My time has been so fearfully occupied. Oh, well, originally I started, I joined the Masons because I thought that was a nice thing to do, because they are a charitable organization. And as I said before, I can't just belong to something without being very active. This was after I took all kinds of my examinations, and I vowed I'd never do anything that I would require to learn anything again, to pass an examination. Well, you have to pass some kind of an examination in Masons. And I was doing very well and became quite interested, until I found out that in Pittsburgh you could not become a 32nd degree, I think that's it, a Mason, if you were a Jew. And I paid my membership dues for a year in advance and wrote them a letter and told them that I would not belong to an organization.
Have you done anything politically?
No.
Were you in the war?
Well, I was in, while in medical school, we were in the ROTC or whatever you call it, so that we could finish medical school. But we never got into the war.
Tell me what you remember about the Depression.
Well, I really don't remember too much, because we were more or less always under some kind of financial stress and strain. So I don't have any special recollection of the Depression.
Do you have any special recollections about Prohibition?
Yes. I had friends, and I remembered when we'd go out, two of my friends, one of them belonged to the Elks, and I recall going there on Saturday evening, whatever dates we could get, and everybody brought a bottle of liquor. I don't drink. I don't claim that as a virtue. I don't drink because it makes me sick when I take a drink, so I have a built-in protection. But the boys would bring liquor along, and speakeasies were abundant, and we naturally would go out to look for these places. It was a noble experiment.
Is there anything that you'd like to say about your relationship with your colleagues? Anything that stands out in any way?
It has been, as I indicated, a very intimate relationship, because at a time when Jews did not really have access to influential medical organizations, whether they were teaching organizations or medically political organizations, I became very much interested in our local setup, Kaddish Medical Society, and for many, many years I was chairman of the Committee on Medical Information, which meant that I had contact with the newspapers, and Johnny Troen, who's editor of the Press Today, got his training in medical stories with me, because we'd sit for hours and talk about what was happening. Not that they would allow me to censor what appeared in the papers, but they would submit it to me for accuracy. Then I became very active in the State Society in a similar committee. Now, I'd like to point out that there's been a tremendous change in Pittsburgh medicine in the past 10 years, only 10 years, 10, 12 years, with reference to tolerance towards Jewish medical men. In other words, today, I think one-third of the class or more in medical school are Jews, and there's no discrimination whatsoever. Certainly not at the medical school, and for all that I know, at any of the other outstanding hospitals in Pittsburgh. A Jew, if he's qualified, applies, and he gets in if he wants to get in. So all of the terrible restrictions and hindrances and obstructions that we met with are practically gone now. The faculty, no one, if I ask Leo, my son is so Jewish, I don't know. They're not aware of Jewishness.
In other words, all the hospitals you're saying are, you know, in Pittsburgh.
I think that even the Mercy Hospital today would, and the St. Francis would welcome a Jew for an internship, or not welcome, but seek him. Of course, part of that is due to the fact that the teaching institutions grab all the desirable material, and the Jewish boys, let's face it, as a rule, are fairly competent. But the school has access to all kinds of material, and Jewishness does not play a role in promotion or in admission or anything else. And this has been a tremendous, tremendous progress in the right direction.
How do you count the fact that that's so recent, it's 10 years?
I can't tell you. I really don't know. War, maybe. I just don't know.
Does
I can't
it,
explain that
does
because
it play?
I don't think it has, I'm not sure, but I don't think it's true of, maybe it's true of the legal profession too. I don't know. I understand that some of the big firms in the city will accept here and there a Jewish lawyer. Now, I'm not an authority on the subject, and I speak from an impression, but I do know what's happening in medicine.
Does it play any part in getting along with your colleagues?
Not at all. Not at all. You keep your nose clean, and your reputation is clean, and you're accepted for what you are worth. And
tell me the difference between the way you were raised and the way you raised your children. Is there a great difference?
Well, the difference is the same as it is with all the other families. I mean, youngsters today have no anxiety about the future. I'm a great believer in genetics. I think that the influence of one's environment is much less important in the development of a generation than the type of chromosomes that they inherit. I don't mean to say that environment doesn't play a role, but it plays a relatively lesser role than the type of chromosomes the children inherit. This accounts for the fact, for example, that two children born in the same family, in the same environment, may be completely different in their attitudes and their goals and their emotional reaction to their environment and so on.
But did you raise them differently than your parents raised you?
Well, I raised them differently only insofar as I couldn't help myself, because the age of permissiveness has been and is rampant. I'm not too sure that that's good, but maybe it is good. There's one thing good about it, and that is that the children today do not have the anxiety about the future that we have.